Today I have Angela Tullerson. We go back like broken recliners. She keeps bees in Montana, and where it seems between our talks that that state just tries to kill everything, and she'll tell us more about that. And let's bring in Angela now.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good.
So just for my audience, for people who don't know you, except, you know, we all have a lot of people that we know from Facebook, but on YouTube, they may not know who you are. So tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you got into messing with bees. Sorry.
Sure. So my great uncle was the, he ran the agriculture department and down in Santa Rosa, California, and he kept bees as part of his job there. And so I was exposed to them from a very young age and learned quite a lot about bees from him very young. We'd go into his lab, accompany him. In fact, I even inherited his hive tool that he started using in the 50s. So I use that out in my yard. But I didn't do much with them until I got quite a bit older. My sister was keeping bees. She had some dead outs in Colorado because it was very cold where she was at. She had moved up here to Montana and she wanted to know if I wanted her equipment. I had just moved out onto property on a farm where I felt like I could actually keep bees successfully. And so I dove in and went for it. I started attending a local bee club here in Kalispell, Montana. A year later, the leader of the club had to move away. And he asked me if I wanted to take over because at the time there were only four of us in the club, even though there is a huge amount of beekeepers in the area. I'm not sure why the club was so small at the time, but I do know that a lot of it might be because commercial beekeepers do not overwinter here in Montana. It's too cold. Their losses are well over 50%. One year, the BIP survey showed that it was 70% losses. And so nobody overwinters their bees here. And so I think that might be part of the reason why the participation is so low in hobbyist beekeeping up here, because the commercial guys weren't even bothering to do it. And so there wasn't a lot of inspiration locally. And so when I took over, I suddenly had people asking me questions when I only had a year in beekeeping. Now, I had a degree in biology, chemistry, and computer science, so I had some zoological background, some scientific training background, but that doesn't mean that I had any experience whatsoever. And I felt really out of my comfort level giving advice to people. And so I decided to jump in feet first, and I went and tested out, got my apprentice level, and then journeyman level, and then finally master beekeeping certification from the University of Montana. And so I'm technically certified now as a master beekeeper. I'm only in my fifth season. And so there's still so many experience lessons for me to learn. I have the science down pat, but it's been quite a chore trying to keep bees alive up here in Kalispell. Our last snow every year is June 8th, and our first freeze is usually September 8th. So it's an extremely short forage window. It's very hard to rear your own queens. Queen rearing season for us is June. And so because of that, there's a mass amount of hobbyists that are purchasing bees from southern states, either in the form of packages or nukes, and bringing them up here. I only know of two businesses that are actually trying to overwinter bees and sell them as nukes here in Montana. And they're way down south, about 6 hours south of me, where they have a little bit bigger of a forage window. And I think their success rates are not anywhere near the people that are raising them down in Southern California, which is the majority of where we tend to, Texas, Georgia, and Southern California is where we tend to import our bees from. So it's a little bit hard to maintain good genetics in my area because I actually have a commercial beekeeper that overwinters his bees in California. And then he takes them through the whole entire pollination circuit, winding up in Washington, doing the apples and cherries. And then he brings them over and he sets them literally 300 yards from my bees. And so to try to claim that I'm able to maintain good genetics with my bees when I'm doing open mating is probably not very realistic. So it's been a bit of a struggle for me. I haven't had any total and complete losses since my first year 5 years ago. But this last year, I went into the winter with four. By November, two of them had died. I tested them. One of them was a swarm capture from my commercial neighbor. They had a mite load of 40 bees per the 300 bees, or 40 mites for the 300 bee sampling, which is pretty excessive. And I had just captured them as a swarm in the end of June. And then my other one had a mite count of 35. So they were no longer mite resistant, even though they had come, they were, it was the granddaughter of a VSH queen, purchase queen. And so through open mating, she had lost any ability to have good genetics to take care of that. And then so that I had two that were strong, had low mite counts, no nosema. And then the other one died last March because we had 3 weeks of 50 degrees and then we had negative 20 degrees. And yeah, when I went in there, their mite counts were extremely low. They only had five mites in the sampling. They had starved. And that's because I'm actively trying to keep bees up here in Northwest Montana in singles. And so I'm experimenting with that, seeing what I can get through the winter. And those clearly needed a lot more honey over them in order to get through. They had brooded up. They had broken cluster. I found bees all over the frames. And so I think they just couldn't withstand the flash freeze that we had without the honey that they needed. So I've got one hive going really strong. And so that's what I plan to propagate from this year. I catch multiple swarms every year, both in traps or I'm called and asked to come collect them. So cool. I'm sustainable up here.
Well, one thing that I say a lot on here and in comments and things is not everybody can always work on their genetics and having, you know, a very tolerant line of bees where they're at just because of their situation, whether there's a commercial beekeeper 300 yards away, or now you have not only that, but then you have the most terrible cold weather there possible. You have so many things working against you. Keeping long lines of bees like I can in Pennsylvania, you know, we just don't deal with those temperatures, but you're still not contributing to the problem. You're a treatment-free beekeeper over here. We're all treatment. I mean, this is a treatment-free channel, period. But you know, you can still enjoy beekeeping. You catch your swarms, mm-hmm. you know, study your bees, you do everything, you do the beekeeping part. But not everybody is going to get to form or to breed down a really tight line of great bees all the time. It's just not possible. So that's something that a lot of people get. They get hung up on because they live in some town where there's a bunch of crappy bees all around. And they just think that everybody should be able to produce their own line of bees. And it's just not possible. So what I like to ask you is, you know, how you would answer the question, what happens if a whole region, say a landlocked region like the Americas, can, you know, all of us, what would happen if everybody in the whole land completely stopped treating? This is hypothetical, of course, because that'll never happen. But from the bees' perspective, not from commercial beekeepers and pollination and honey production, what would happen to the bees?
So the species would continue because we already have a precedent for that in multiple countries. This has been talked about quite a bit recently in a lot of podcasts. It's actually been kind of encouraging to see a high amount of scientists that have no sway through money or, you know, they don't have any complications or politics. They're just scientists, and they have been interviewed quite a bit on podcasts. Evolutionary biologists, bee scientists, talking about how other countries that did not have the money to do treatments, one of the first ones that's mentioned is Africa, when they just never introduce a single treatment, that the bees are the bees that survived are the ones that were able to adapt, and they're surviving over there. So would the species die out completely because of mites? Probably not. However, there's always things that are going to attack another organism. There's always a new parasite. There's always a new virus. We can't with any surety say that the Western honeybee, Apis mellifera, will exist here in, you know, 10,000 years, 20,000 years. But the Apis mellifera itself has been around for a million that we know of. Apis in general has been around much longer. But it would be naive to say that this is what was going to completely wipe them out. That's just not how nature works. And there's always an adaptation and an arms race when you have organisms that are both trying to survive.
Right. And sometimes I think about the insects that we don't even keep track of, like, for example, say yellow jackets or bald-faced hornets. Mm-hmm. What are the chances? I think they're pretty high that just from people traveling, things being shipped back and forth, that some type of parasite or bacteria did not introduce itself to the bald-faced hornet population. But nobody goes around and worries about bald-faced hornets. They just notice one year there's a whole bunch. Next year there weren't so many this year. I wonder why that is. They go through the same selection. They get absolutely bombarded by some type of fungus, some type of parasite. Mm-hmm. And this is done over and over many, many times in insects, plants, birds, anything. With bees, they get this special, they have this, people just think that they'll never survive without us. So that's just something that I think about.
I think commercial beekeeping might not survive. And that's been stated several times, or at least the migratory version of it might not. So that does give me pause, because I'm sympathetic to people's way of life, how they make their money, how they support themselves. I'm sympathetic to our agriculture system and how it's dependent on it. And I don't want to be so hard-hearted as to say, well, so, you know, 70% of the bees will die, but then the 30% that will left will be great. I understand that that would completely upend our society. And so for a bit, we would get over it, but it would be devastating to the people that rely on this for their income. And so I don't think there's an easy answer. I don't have an answer for that. I do know, as a hobbyist, I do not have to make the same decisions as a commercial person. And right. I'm grateful for not having to make those decisions.
And that's a good point too, that a lot of people who only plan to keep a handful of colonies in their yard for fun decide that they want to go to people with tens of thousands of colonies that depend on everything, you know, depend on that for their livelihood to learn how to manage three hives. Do you know any of the history of what happened soon after mites came here? What happened to the commercial beekeeping industry, say, before there were any treatments available, when all those wipeouts were happening? I really don't know. Did we lose a lot of pollination?
I don't know. I know that we currently are right now. I know that the supposed 40% that's reported right now, commonly from the commercial guys, especially the ones that overwinter down in California, that they're saying that it's making their businesses barely sustainable. I know a lot of them have gotten out of the businesses because of it. You've had an extreme amount of theft going on. There's a Montana beekeeper up here on the east side of Montana that had thousands and thousands of dollars worth of hives stolen from him when he went down to pollinate in Yuba City, California. And those guys were apprehended. They were actually had stolen millions of dollars worth of bees from other people. So I understand that they're having a problem right now. The mite is definitely, any stressor that you have on an organism is going to contribute to its demise. But there's a lot of people, especially entomologists like Jonathan Lundgren, that believe that it is just a contributor to the overall stress that we're putting on the system via the pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides that we use at the agricultural level. And one of the things that I keep seeing pop up over and over in scientific articles, this was mentioned quite a bit at APAMONDIA 2019 in Montreal, because that particular year, the theme was agriculture, working with the beekeepers. And nutrition is huge in the bee's ability to bounce back and have a good immune system. And we hamper that nutrition in two ways. First, we don't have the forage that we used to, because of monocultures, because of concrete that's laid down, because of our loss of wildflowers. Secondly, there are sublethal effects to all of the chemicals that we use. And so while it might not kill a hive outright fatally, where you have the bees spinning around on the ground and dying in front of it, there's huge impacts to the learning behaviors of bees. Their hygiene ability and their mating ability is all impacted by these neurotoxins that we're trying to kill an insect that lives on an insect, I've heard said before. And it's having a big impact on our bees, not only our bees, but our entire insect biome. I believe we're down to only 60% of what we were in the early 1900s before the advent of big chemical use in agriculture. So that's going to have a trickle-up effect to everything. Everything that eats the insects is going to be affected until it works its way up to humans. So it's way more complicated than just mites. I feel like mites is something that a side story that's just distracting us from a bigger problem.
Okay. And then I remember I sent a link to you maybe a few weeks ago. They were talking about certain things like monarch butterflies, how when humans try to help out an insect like monarch butterflies, everybody likes to raise those in their little butterfly tents and set them free, that it turns out the people from the monarch society of whatever that big outfit is want you to stop doing that and let these monarchs go take their, you know, rise and falls in population so they can thin the weak out. And
yes,
and I just see that all over the whole movement of trying to save things.
Yeah. One of the problems I had recently, watched some videos yesterday from the University of Guelph up in Ontario, is they've started a breeding program called LVG, or low varroa growth, where they're trying to breed bees that have, it's kind of sounds like almost right now a black box scenario where you don't really know why they're controlling the mites. You just know that the counts are low. So that is their primary objective, is low mite counts. And they're trying to breed them. Well, in the third installment of the video, they were visiting with the president of the Ontario Beekeeping Club, I believe, or Technology Club. And he actually stated in there at one point of the video that when you get to the end of the season, you should treat all of the colonies, because any that fail to control themselves need to be knocked back down so that you don't send out any mites into the rest of the population. And my first thought was, wait a second, if you're trying to do a breeding program where you're coming up with this felt bee that can control the varroa, why would you sustain the ones that are failing by knocking the mites down so they will survive, so that they can put their drones, can go out there and open mate with your hygienic queens? I don't understand.
Yeah.
It just, that didn't make sense at all. And that's the problem that we're running into over and over and over. Everybody wants their cake, but they want to eat it too.
Yeah, you know? It's baffling. And I hear that in many different ways all the time from even some really big beekeepers. They'll say, we're working on these bees that have these low mite numbers, but then we still treat them anyway. And I just think that's not how selection works.
No.
It's like I talk a lot about moving the goalposts, and that's what I got into a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a bigger beekeeper on a live like this. And I tried to explain to him, he's not used to being spoken to the way I talk to these people. And I say, listen, I got bees here that I've had since, four or five of my lines are from 2017, 2016. It's the same line of bees I've never treated in my whole life. So you can keep, these bees can be pretty, you have a good chance of doing well with them. If someone were to come to me and say, hey, I just want some of your best queens so I can produce them or just mass produce them. But then he said, well, okay, maybe they might survive, but then are they going to produce this certain amount of honey? Are they going to be this gentle? And just started adding all these different things to the thing. Mm-hmm. And then usually the conversation always goes, well, if you can produce 20,000 of those and send them to me, I'll take them. It's like, I'm just one person here trying to have fun with some bees. So now you just made it totally impossible. So now we're done talking, you know. But right. The goalpost movement is crazy. Like, say you're breeding racehorses. You just want the fastest possible horse. But then you bring it to someone, they're like, oh, but we want it to be brown with white spots. And it has to be a certain size. And it has to only eat a certain amount of food. They just move it all the way till it's not possible anymore. I think that's the biggest stumbling block.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That video that you sent me of the evolutionary biologist that was speaking at the Georgia conference, he made a really good point that selecting for certain traits, it's always like a seesaw or a teeter-totter. When one drops, something else is going to rise on the other end, and you just have to live with it, you know? And we've chosen to just live with, okay, I've got to suit up a little bit better. My bees are going to be a little bit more testy. They're going to conserve their honey a little bit more. As hobbyists, we have that ability. The consignment that commercial guys have made is, I'm willing to use chemicals in my hive. And, you know, so we're each doing what we feel like is our consignment that we can make. And I'm happy with my consignment, you know, that I just might get a little bit more aggressive bees and I might keep a little less honey. That's why I'm actively trying to get singles through the winter up here. Most people, in order to get bees through our area up here in Montana, have to keep doubles or triples and 100 pounds of honey over them. And they add extra sugar on top. I'm just not willing to lose 100 pounds of honey. To me, that what's the point of keeping bees, especially if they die anyways, and they've gone through 100 pounds of honey. So I actively do insulation up here to try to get the number smaller and smaller so that I'm not seeing so much honey go out the door.
Yeah, and that's also another thing. Like, a lot of people get hung up on the fact that they absolutely need their two or three colonies or five. They need them to survive. They just have this feeling that if they don't, that they're a failure somehow. But you could, if you know, you could, it may not seem ethical to some people, and we were talking about it. You could, if you wanted to just be a honey producer, you could get enough bees to produce enough honey that you wanted and not really care about the bees dying. You know, what was that one situation you were telling me about? They don't even bother with wintering. They just take all the honey and get rid of the bees.
Yeah. So over in the east side of Montana, an article was just published in Hobby Farms by a good friend of mine, Amy Grissick. They essentially, what they did for years, way back about 50 years ago, was they killed the bees every fall, and so that they could have all the honey. And then in the spring, they would buy packages, 10 to 20,000 packages, and bring them back up to Montana. And they would do that year after year. Well, they found they actually made more money if they resold the bees back down to Southern California beekeepers in the form of packages. So they're shaking the entire hive into a package and then reselling it at about 60 to 70% its original value back to California beekeepers, who take them down and put them in dead outs, use them to boost other numbers, use them to replace queens that they might have lost. There's quite a bit more summer deaths with commercial beekeepers than us hobbyists experience. And so they've got the equipment, they've got the resources, they dump the package of bees in. And so this honey company up here in Montana is making a lot of money just through their honey and then reselling the bees back. And then they start it over again the next spring.
Okay, so they used to just kill the bees, or mm-hmm. and they did fine then. I mean, nobody. I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. Nobody wants to do it. But they're strictly about the business. So, mm-hmm. but now they just found a way to recoup a little bit of their money back, or a mm-hmm. good amount of it. So, mm-hmm. I don't know about being hung up on keeping these bees alive over the winter. And it seems like every spring, I've never heard the beekeeping package industry. Since I've been messing with bees, say, hey, you know what? It's been a rough time. There's not going to be any packages available for all you hobbyists. They always somewhere find them, you know, mm-hmm. every year. Mm-hmm. So how is the 40% or 50% really impacting anything?
From what I understand, they're fully recuperating. So we have the 40% losses, but that doesn't mean that that is our net bees. We're completely replacing the bees every year. Right. So that's, yeah. So that's misleading. I don't want people to think every year we're cutting 40%, 40%, 40%. We don't. They're able to reproduce and replace those bees. Just it's probably a cost that they don't want to have to accrue. They would probably like if they were only losing 10% of their bees, because it would be a little less work. But they're replacing those bees every year, is my understanding from the data.
Right. I think that was another conversation I had, was people focusing on the winter decline in your numbers of bees. I don't like to call them losses, as you know, especially when you don't pay for any bees, but they never want to, count what you do from April to July. You know, you turn the 40 or 50 that you have into 150, you know, so losing 40% again, it's almost a positive, you know, from year to year. If you just have a little bit of experience in knowing how to split bees up. I mean,
well, anyone who's ever really studied ecosystems and the way that species maneuver through their trials and tribulations understands that all species way overproduce, with the understanding that only 30 to 40 to 50% may actually survive. Everything is just trying to just replace itself, technically. If we had, stop and think about this, if in nature, bees were successful enough to double every year, they would become an extreme nuisance in nature, oh, yeah. right? If deer were able to double every year, they would be an extreme nuisance. If wolves were able to double every year, they would be an extreme nuisance. So we need to quit thinking that in order for the bee species to be successful, you should be doubling every year and having no losses. That is against nature's intention. And it's also against nature's intention for insects to survive for years and years, the way you think of a cow that you own, or a dog that you own, or sheep that you own. That is not how insects survive. Insects' purpose is to find another insect to reproduce with, make double what they need, knowing that half of it's going to die, and then you've just barely eked through another year, and you've just barely survived the parasites that were attacking you, and just barely survived the viruses. The viruses and the parasites have the exact same goal. They just want to, sometimes they're going to get killed off, and sometimes they're going to make it. And it's just this little tiny arms race where things are just eking forward. Now I'm going to eke forward. Now I am. And it just goes that way through the eons. And it's really unrealistic for us to take something out of nature like bees that's meant to be wild and then completely alter its behavior in our yards.
Right. And then the treatments themselves, sorry about that. The treatments themselves do even double time badness, because mm-hmm. they're selecting mites. They're selecting the top 1% of mites. Every round of OA or formic, whatever you do, they're selecting the best.
Yes.
The best top percentage. And
yeah.
Meanwhile, the bees are just kicking back, doing nothing for a free ride.
Yep. That's what was mentioned actually in the very first video, in the U of G video that I mentioned, where they've started this program. He actually says that exact phrase. Every time we use miticides, we allow the 5% strongest, most prolific mites to survive in every hive, and that we are interfering and selecting and making making a parasite that's going to be almost unkillable by the bees. We're really doing them a disservice.
So here's something you probably read a lot that I see a lot too, and I see in a lot of videos all the time. The beekeepers have a different way of talking about things, and especially treatment-free beekeepers and treating beekeepers. But if I were to be in a conversation with a treating beekeeper, they'll say something along the lines of, well, we all just want the healthiest bees going into winter so we keep our bees healthy. But to me, bees that have had every type of obstacle removed from them, they may appear healthy at the time. It's like looking at a person on steroids with the best diet ever. Yeah, they look healthy, but that's not actual health to me. When you do the cleaning of the mites for them, they're not healthy. They're not survivors either.
No. In fact, I see very commonly people refer to livestock as a metaphor to try to shame beekeepers into treating. You know, you would take care of your cows. You would give your cows medicine. You would give your sheep, you know,
or your children.
Yeah, I know. So to that effect, I should actually tell you what I learned. So I recently started keeping Merino sheep for their fiber 2 years ago. And I went to a class online where they were teaching me how to detect parasites in the sheep's eyes. And one particular parasite that's a real problem is called the barber pole worm. And the sheep pick it up by defecating on grass and then re-eating the grass. And so it has part of its life cycle down on the grass. The sheep ingest it, and then it causes a problem again. It causes them to become extremely anemic. And you can tell by the loss of color in their eyelids. And so there are antiparasitics out there, ivermectin specifically, for this problem. Interestingly, the suggestion by my teachers in this USDA-sponsored, nationally accredited group was, if you find sheep that have this parasite, cull them. Don't breed from them. Don't treat them. Because if you treat them, we're actually seeing resistance to ivermectin in some of these barber pole worms. And we are causing a problem that we're never going to be able to use this anymore. And so the suggestion was stop breeding from that sheep and cull it. And so we see even the USDA recognizes in livestock, just using antiparasitics to destroy parasites is causing a problem that we are now trying to pull back from. And they're saying, find resistant stock. If you have stock that are resistant to this barber pole worm, avidly breed from them and cull the rest. Wow. So that, yeah. And so, you know, so I kind of recall that story every time somebody tries to pull the, well, you would give your sheep or your cows or your whatever medicine if they were sick. No, not according to the USDA.
And the other thing is with your sheep or cows or whatever, you control the breeding of those things. They're not running around with the wild population. It would be great if there was something you could just give to your bees and it would make all your drones sterile or something. Maybe that's something. It just sterilizes them all. And then I would say treat to your heart's content, because you're just keeping those drones. Maybe it wouldn't work. I don't know if that would work, but
I see where you're going with it. But yeah, it's,
you could just keep them really from. You could make sure that only the best possible bees are being allowed to mate, I guess. So with those sheep, you can't just sterilize them or whatever, you spay them or neuter them. I don't know. What do you do to sheep?
Not at that age. No, it's not safe. It's only something. Yeah. No, you would just take them out of the breeding cycle and take them out of your yard. You don't want them putting that, you know, those insect eggs down on your grass. So effectively you're sending them to market to be turned into meat.
And then some sheep simply don't get the worms, or
they're naturally resistant.
Oh, they just don't get them at all.
They just don't get them. They're just resistant. And so the USDA's suggestion is, you know, breed from those, cull the rest. We need to get off of antiparasitics. They're not working anymore.
And you would think that something like that, you know, sheep don't go out and go on mating walks or whatever with a whole bunch of random sheep. That would probably be not easy, but probably easier to breed for perfection with those than
it is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and just with you talking about sheep, it just reminded me of that. There's a video where these rock climbing sheep, I don't know what kind of sheep they are, or goats, but they walk up this cliff, like it's almost sheer. It just has, they can walk up sideways because to get the little salt that they lick at the top, but it's like thousands of feet tall and they're just running along this wall. But every once in a while, some fall down. And not only are they up on the wall, but there's actual cats that can chase them around on that wall. It's just crazy to see them living on practically a wall. But of course, some of them fall down. That's how the selection works. But then I was reading some of the comments where people felt so bad for those ones that fell down, and they thought that we should build some type of little shelves on the wall so that the sheep can just get up there carefully and not fall down. And that's the mindset that we have in beekeeping.
You know, so my experience, what first got me interested in the zoological sciences was up here in Montana, when I was in high school, we were learning about all of the case scenarios where we had interjected our attempt to fix something and had made a bigger problem. And one of those particular scenarios was that we had a problem with a pine beetle getting in to our pine trees and killing them. And so we decided to bring in an outside bug that was not native to this area called a stink bug because they eat the larva of the pine beetle. And we decided we were going to bring the stink bug in and release it by the thousands. And they are now naturalized to our area, and they are huge pests. We had a problem where, you know, a lot of the wolves were driven out of our area. And so they decided they were going to bring wolves back into our area. Well, the problem is they didn't bring our original wolves that were not much bigger than coyotes here. They went and got these wolves from Canada that are gigantosaurs, and they brought them down into the area and they started decimating the elk populations. So what we see over and over is when we attempt to go in and fix a problem and we inject ourselves into a balanced ecosystem that was dealing with its issues in whatever way it could, that we just completely upend things. And that's something that we have to keep in mind whenever we're trying to mess with the balances that nature has put into perspective.
Yeah, so I'm guessing the pine beetles are still there, though?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I know we still have a lot of disease in our trees. I don't know how effective the program has been. That's something that I should look up and see how it's doing now. I do know I have a lot of stink bugs in my house.
So they have predatory stink bugs too? Because we have stink bugs, but I don't remember that they, I know they mostly drink sap from different plants, but they have, I just didn't know. They have, do they just poke in there and suck the larvae out of the tree trunks, the stink bugs?
I don't know. That's a good
When I hear a new bug, I just got to know what
that is. I know. Yeah. I'm sure there's multiple stink bugs, but yeah.
So now that I have you here, we can talk about a couple of the things that we come across all the time as moderators on the Treatment Free Beekeeping group. And one of those that, man, I get blue in the face talking about what people consider a treatment, what they don't consider a treatment. And then I've said it so many times, it's almost like, it's just like, I just get tired of saying it. They'll say, well, if I'm not using a certain chemical, then it's not a treatment, which of course we agree that it doesn't matter if it's a chemical or not. Anything you do to try to affect in 99% of the time, it's mites. Like putting a mouse guard is not a treatment because some bee colonies just don't have a entrance big enough for mice. So we just do that to keep them out. But brood breaks come up all the time, and we kind of, I don't know. I know my reasons for thinking that it's really something you want to avoid doing, but what do you think about those?
Yeah, so I want to be clear about why I became a treatment-free beekeeper. It was not because I had an ideology that it was purely from a scientific perspective as someone who has studied ecosystems and the proper balance. And I like to look at things at a bigger picture holistically. I'm a regenerative farmer, which means I tend to focus on the land taking care of itself if the ecosystem is in balance. And so when people think that we are nitpicking about treatments because of an ideology, they're misunderstanding. It's not about getting bogged down in the intentions of what a person is doing. It's about what you are actually physically doing in order to keep bees and the lines that I'm drawing. There are some people who draw their line after feeding, and there are some people that draw their line before feeding as propping up. There are some of us that draw their line at any manipulations that you have to do that would help the bees get through the summer when normally they would not have, or get through the winter when normally they would not have on their own. And that's simply what we're trying to foster there. If you have to do a brood break, this is hypothetically if brood breaks worked, which I'm going to cover that in a second. If you have to do a brood break in order for your bees to survive and they normally wouldn't have, have you really latched on to survivor genetics? Or are you having to do a complicated manipulation that's just trouble for you, that you feel like you have to repeat for every single colony, every single year in order to get them through? If those are the bees you want to keep, no problem. Keep them that way. We're not interested in manipulating people's choices or lives. What we're interested in is keeping an idea, a regimen going in the group where it's, you do not have to do that manipulation if you don't want to. And so it's not going to be discussed here. It's not going to be propagated to make people feel like they have to do that to be successful. We have so many new people coming into the group that want to know, what are you doing to be successful? And it's frustrating when I see dozens of people saying brood breaks make me successful, when I actually know that they are not making you successful. How do I know that? Well, a study was done in 2010 where, let me just pull up the title here if anyone wants to look at it. It was Wagnitz and Ellis, and they did combining an artificial break in brood rearing with oxalic acid treatment to reduce varroa mite levels. And this particular one, they published this one in the Science of Bee Culture in 2010. And interestingly, they made a really good point. So what they were seeing was immediately after a brood break, the mite levels doubled in all of the colonies. Why did they double? Well, it's obvious. If you shut down the brood for the bees, then all of that brood, since 80% of the mites live under the caps, all of that brood that emerges the two or three or weeks following, as they're coming out, all of these mites are emerging with them to the tune of about 5 mites per bee, but you've only got one bee emerging. And so if you do a mite wash immediately following this brood break, you will find that the ratio of mites to bees has doubled what it was before the brood break. Huh. And that's because you've reduced the bees population. So you haven't improved your mite numbers. You've made it worse.
Oh, okay.
And then on top of that, you have, because you have a low population, you have less foragers. They're having to remain to do duties inside as nurse bees. And so you have less honey coming in, less resources, less foragers, and the colonies were not as strong later on. When they ran the numbers, so they did this in August, and then they tested later in, I believe it was October, to see what the overall effect was. Interestingly, according to this graph here that you can see yourself if you look up this study, there is...
I think you can share the screen if you want to. I don't know if you...
I'm on the wrong device. I've got it up on the other screen, so I'm okay. Sorry I can't share it on here. The numbers of mites to ratio, the ratio of mites to bees for whether they just recreened, just did oxalic acid, or the untreated colonies entirely is no different. It's no different. So the mite levels, those three things did not improve the mite levels. They claimed that the mite levels were greatly reduced when they did the combination of the oxalic acid and the requeening, but the starting numbers of the mites were way higher than the other groups. And so it looks like it was really effective, but in reality, it didn't knock it down that much more than the other groups that they left completely alone, or that they just requeened, or that they just did oxalic acid. So here's my thinking in the brood breaks. If you, they were caging the queens for 21 days.
Wow.
And yeah, that's quite a long time. So another study that was done where they were, I believe in 2017, and then there's also one again in 2020, what they were finding was that when they caged the queens to do a study on the mites, and then they reintroduced the queens, there was a high rate of the colonies superseding that queen. And it's because it went so long without the brood pheromone and the queen pheromone that they decided instinctively that something was wrong with the queen. And when she was reintroduced, they superseded her almost immediately and killed her unnecessarily. There was nothing wrong with her. It was because of a manipulation that the humans had done. And in fact, they actually postulated that that is a good theory of why it's so common for package bees to supersede their queen immediately after she started laying eggs. We see that a lot. It's because of how long they were without brood as opposed to nukes.
So then a comeback, usually when I say brood breaks, aside from being basically pointless, it's, and some of what you said, which is if you have to do it, then you don't have survivor stock, but they'll say, well, bees swarm, so that then they have a brood break. Or what happens when you do splits? Now you're doing a brood break, like the gotcha, they got you with that.
Yeah.
But what I try to say is bees have been swarming forever.
Beekeepers, and they still have mites.
Yeah, and beekeepers have been doing splits forever. You can't confuse normal beekeeping things that happen with the intentional situation where you're counting mites and then you go, okay, now I'm going to cage my queen for 21 days or split at a time when you normally wouldn't have done it. There's two totally different things.
It is. So I mentioned that I have a commercial guy that is right near me, and I catch swarms from him every single year. And I have absolutely no moral compunctions doing that because they're free bees. It never occurred to me to reject his bees because they're treated bees, commercial bees, and not going to be survivor bees. All I care about is that it's fun to keep the bees. It's fun to catch them. It's fun to keep them while I have them. And it's fun to eat the honey when they die.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me that I'm not latching onto the perfect genetics. But year after year, I catch his swarms. I'm sure they're treated because he's a commercial beekeeper. I get them, and they either die right the very first time we have a freeze or at some point in the winter. And when I test the corpses, there's high mite loads. So what I have to ask is, if swarming knocks off several mites when they're flying, which is one of the theories, and it gives them a brood break, it does give them a 2-week brood break because from the time that they leave, they're bivouac for about 3 days, they get established in a hive and start building the comb. She starts laying probably about 3 to 4 days later, but then the mites do not climb in and start feeding and reproducing, right? Mites climb in right before they get capped, which is 8 days after she's laid her first egg. And then the mite gets in there and the mite starts reproducing. And then it's another anywhere, well, it depends on whether it's a worker or a drone, but another week to 2 weeks before they've emerged and the mite emerges with them. So you're getting a break from mites for 3 weeks. And yet, when I capture these in the end of June, by October or November, when they die from a really good freeze, they've already built back up to 40 mites in a count of 300 bees. Why? I thought the brood break was supposed to work. I thought the swarming was supposed to work. You can't out manipulate bad genetics.
That gives you an indication of just how helpless they are, like how just indifferent they are to mites. They just, like, we know, right, Someone's coming to save us any day now. We're just going to do nothing whatsoever about it.
So here's an even more extreme example. Our bees stop brooding at the end of October, and most bees, maybe a little bit in November, most of the bees have emerged from the brood, but because we have freezes starting in September and we lose all of our forage, the bees start shutting down very early. And then we don't have our first significant brood until March. So that's a brood break of how many months? And yet every single Montana beekeeper that's a treater has to treat in the beginning of the spring with oxalic acid, or they find themselves, their mite counts start climbing and they have to treat in the summer with the formic acid or the Apivar, whatever they're using. So if brood breaks work, then how come a 4 to 5 month brood break in Montana is not, how come we have mites in Montana? Is it just because they're bringing them up with them in the nukes? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that is what keeps the mites at bay. And, you know, I would really encourage people to go and look at these studies where they are doing the queen caging in an attempt to deal with the mites, because it's really eye-opening. The mites have this incredible ability when their populations have been knocked down to counteract and react to it and adapt and immediately explode their populations. And, you know, it's silly for us to think that only the bees have RNA traits that alter their behavior to deal with mites, but the mites don't. If the mites sense that their numbers have been depleted significantly, they also do counteractive measures to boost those. And that what I'm seeing in these is that that's a problem over and over. I was watching a queen rearing video from Sam Comfort last night, and he was explaining that he does a couple of brood breaks per hive for his queen rearing. He mentioned multiple brood breaks through the season to help. And he mentioned, and it keeps the mites back. And he goes, but you know what? It really, really messes with the population of the bees too. Like, the populations are so low that I found myself spending $10,000 a year in sugar in order to prop up my hives. And he said, I thought to myself, how I was supposed to be doing permaculture practices and regenerative practices, and yet I'm buying $10,000 a year in white sugar to prop up my bees for my brood breaks. So his answer was to convert from singles to doubles. And he said, the bigger the colony, the less sugar I have to feed them, and then they can deal with the fact I'm doing brood breaks better. And so you can see that doing brood breaks hampers the growth of your bees. And for me up here in Montana, where they have such a forage window, that is not something that I'm willing to do.
Right. And just like you said, I've captured bees that I've caught them as a swarm. So they went into a box with zero comb, foundationless frames. Mm-hmm. We can catch them very early. I catch them early April, and then by June, they're already swarming again. So not only were they a swarm, but then they swarmed, and now they're three different colonies, and they still die anyway. So on the other side of that, I've also had bees that have been in the exact same box with the same marked queen for three seasons that I only weaken them enough to keep them from swarming, just to keep making little splits, because I had my prize queen in there, and they never died, never been treated. That was zero brood breaks for three seasons. So yeah, it's definitely, I'm not on board with brood breaks.
No.
Swarming is what bees do. Splitting is what beekeepers do to, you know, hold, keep their bees in their yard. And it's nothing new.
No. And I'm not saying that you should avoid brood breaks. I think it's a natural process, and I think it's a great way to make queens to do your splits. So sure, do a walkaway split where you've moved the queen over with a couple of frames of brood, and then the other one starts raising brood. There's been very little study done in the field of what the overall implications are of allowing a brood break, not allowing a brood break. But from what I'm seeing in the studies and from my own personal experience, I am not seeing it be the silver bullet that got a poor genetic colony through the winter when it normally wouldn't have. I'm not having
And you just remind me of one more thing we can address. We'll keep this thing down, you know, right around an hour. But I've been seeing it shared around some of the B groups as just fantastic news. This new, I think it was slow release oxalic acid. Or have you heard about that? Where,
yeah,
I don't know what it is. Maybe it's in a pad or something, or some type of way. Oh, was it a gel?
Gelatin on a pad of some kind. Yeah.
I can't think of a worst possible thing to do, or the fastest way to breed the absolute worst bees and the strongest mites ever than by low level, slow release pesticide. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, technically, so the oxalic acid, what they're finding, and it actually is repeated in the study that I just mentioned. I've seen it in multiple other studies, but oxalic acid actually isn't effective in knocking down the mite levels. It's only effective if there's no brood and all of the mites are out. And that's why they even did the study, is they said, okay, if we stop there from being brood by caging the queen, is oxalic acid more effective? And the answer was yes, because you have to attack the mites that are phoretic with oxalic acid. So one of the things that's always bothered me about us advising new beekeepers that they should use oxalic acid in the summer is that, or in the fall, is that it's too late by then, technically. You're supposed to catch the mites before they enter into the cell, because the summer bees are being laid, their eggs are being laid at the end of August, right? You know, sometimes actually, depending on the area, it could even be the beginning of August. And so if you have mites enter the cells in August, the beginning of August, and they start parasitizing those winter bees, you've already lost the battle. And you can't do oxalic acid in August because you're actively having bees that are putting the honey on. And so a lot of people don't want to pull their supers, or you're not really getting any of the mites that are still trapped under the cappings from July's bees that haven't even emerged yet. So it's really not effective. The only time oxalic acid would really be effective is when there's zero brood and in the middle of winter, which is what some people do. And so it really doesn't make sense to me that people mess with oxalic acid at all in the summer or fall. And so I believe this slow release is an answer for that, is if you have the oxalic acid constantly releasing every single time the bees emerge, you're catching the mites. So I believe that is the reason and behind this, because I think everyone's starting to realize oxalic acid actually doesn't work. And there's been so many studies where they have used oxalic acid as a vapor and realized that the mite counts were not any different than the controls at the end of the season.
That's going to get a lot of comments on here. Who is this?
Yeah, the studies are out there. Go look at them, including this one.
Huh. Okay. So that gel would be in the hive. I'm not even interested in it, so I didn't read it, but it's like, is it just something that they put in the summer, and is it in there for like 42 days like that other stuff, or did you read any more about it?
If you want to get some more details, Randy Oliver did publish his study that he did for it on scientificbeekeeping.com. He makes the point of saying that it is illegal, that he got special permission. So, what they're trying to do is find the magic ratio where the oxalic acid is not detectable in the honey. Because if you're going to be doing this for an extended amount of time, you have to have your honey supers on. Right now, that's not legal with oxalic acid, to leave your honey supers on. And so they're trying to make sure that it's safe for human consumption still. And so he's been messing with the levels of what can I get away with that it doesn't enter the honey in higher amounts and it doesn't kill the bees, but it does kill the mites. So it's pretty active study that he's doing. If you want to know the details, I would go look at him on his website.
Yeah, I've seen about as much as I want to see of that website. But all right, well, thank you for coming on. I definitely got to come back when I get some more good questions we can tackle. Anything else you were thinking of? Any parting words?
No. Are you still going to send me a queen to put in one?
Yeah,
of
we'll try it again. We had a tough time last year with the postage handling. But yeah, we'll get that going on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, everyone, this is Angela Tullerson and Bruce Rodriguez. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you.
Take care.